Should I start sharing the title screen, or how do you want?
Yeah, feel free to go ahead.
Okay, let me figure out, make sure it gets into the right not presenter mode. Okay, but wait a minute, where'd you all go? That just made it, sorry, it made it go all. Not letting me share it and then minimize my presenter so then I don't see any of the Zoom. So I was just trying to, if I do.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining us today. We'll start here in just a minute.
Hold on. Let me make sure it's in
Yeah.
presenter code. Okay.
All right. Well, hello everyone. Thank you for joining us today. My name is Paul Bierman. I'm the Director of Education and Events for SNEB. Welcome to today's Journal of Nutrition, Education, and Behavior Journal Club webinar, part of a series of 11 webinars with a focus on nutrition, education, programs, and implications from the field. A special thank you to the SNEB Food and Nutrition Extension Education Division for helping select articles from the journal showcasing the work of cooperative extension nutrition educators. As the official peer-reviewed journal of the Society for Nutrition Education and Behavior, JNEB advances nutrition education and behavior-related research, practice, and policy. Before we begin, I have a few pieces of information to go over. We will take questions at the end of the presentation. During the presentation, please type any questions you may have into the Q&A section or the chat, and they will be moderated out to our panelists. When the webinar ends today, you'll be prompted to complete a short survey. Please take a moment to complete that survey, as your feedback is greatly appreciated for future SNEB webinars. This webinar is being recorded and will be available free of charge to SNEB members in the webinar section of the website. Finally, watch for a follow-up email to be sent in the next few days, which will include a link to the recording for this session, the session handouts, and your CEU certificate for your attendance today. I can now hand things over to our moderator, Dr. Kristen DiFilippo, Teaching Assistant Professor at the University of Illinois.
Thank you,
Kristen?
Paul. Yeah,
Thank
thank you.
you.
We have a wonderful group of speakers here today to share with us. Dr. Laura Bellows is an associate professor in the Division of Nutritional Sciences at Cornell. Her research focuses on development of eating habits and physical activity patterns in early childhood, interventions in the early care setting, and the influence of parental behaviors and the home environment on these on the development of these behaviors. Her recent work is also aimed at digital interventions and evaluation techniques in community-based programs. Dr. Susan Johnson is a professor in the Department of Pediatrics at the University of Colorado Anschutz Medical Center and is the director of the Children's Eating Laboratory. Her primary research is related to factors that influence the development of children's food intake and eating patterns, and her research investigates the effects of child feeding practices on children's food preferences, energy intake patterns, and their weight outcomes. Dr. Barbara Chamberlain is a professor and department head of the Department of Innovative Medical Research and Extension at New Mexico State University. Her interests include educational game design, implementation of technology into informal learning programs, such as after-school programs in 4-H, and the use of technology in the Cooperative Extension Service. She directs the Learning Games Lab, which develops educational games, animations, interactives, apps, and also provides digital technology education outreach for youth. Dr. Lihia Reyes is a postdoctoral associate in the Health Behavior Lab in the Division of Nutritional Sciences at Cornell. Her research focuses on understanding dietary behavior outcomes and how they are socialized early in life and identify intervention areas that can sustainably promote adequate nutrition, especially among populations with limited resources. And finally, Shariva Oak is a PhD candidate in the Division of Nutritional Sciences at Cornell. Her research in community nutrition is focused on advancing the design and implementation of digital interventions for food and physical activities behaviors. I want to thank them for joining us today and sharing their work. I can pass it over to our speakers.
Great. Thanks so much, Kristen and Paul, for inviting us and for the introductions. And as you can see, we have a pretty diverse group of presenters, and partly that's because of the diversity of the skill sets needed to make the work that I'm going to present and others are going to talk about as well to make that happen. So both as researchers and extension, I think this will give a nice overview of how we came together. So just to provide a roadmap for the presentation, I'll start with a background on mobile device use in this age group, and then talk about our HEROES study and where the mobile apps fit into that. And then Shariva will talk about key considerations in the mobile app development. Lahia will talk about the Foods and Moves apps. And then we're going to, at the end, have an opportunity for reflections and insights that Susan will moderate to get mine and Barb's reflections as we've worked together in designing mobile apps. So just to set the stage and provide some background, when we first wrote our USDA grant, you know, a lot of questions were, well, do preschoolers even use apps? The reality is, in today, especially post-COVID as well, that 98% of young children have access to digital devices. And that's mostly smartphones, but also that 42% have tablets that they use. 9 out of 10 young children are introduced to that device before their first birthday. And some of it is FaceTiming with grandparents, but certainly they're using it in other capacities as well. And 60% of children under the age of 3 are using a touchscreen device. So it's become very ubiquitous in early childhood to have access to digital devices. So when we think about mobile apps in this group, it's only been relatively recently that there are recommendations that come out of the American Academy of Pediatrics, but we also need to differentiate the type and the quality of the electronic interaction, and, you know, not lumping it all as one type of screen time, because there is screen time that is educational, and there is screen time that is entertainment, which tends to be more passive, but a lot of parents and even schools, preschools, are using electronic devices for educational purposes. One of the key recommendations, though, for this age group is that the adult, whether it be a childcare provider or a parent, can co-view or co-play with children. And this provides an opportunity for positive parent-child interaction, but a way for active engagement with parents to enhance learning. And there is some data to suggest that that co-viewing or co-play can help with enhanced learning. That said, I think many of us who are parents can recognize that sometimes we do need the entertainment value of a device. And so building apps that children can also use individually or solo, I think at this age group is also an important consideration. So we had a study funded by USDA called the HEROES study, which was intended to build a family intervention with a technology component that focused on healthy eating, physical literacy, and mindful parenting. It was offered in rural Colorado right before or during the pandemic shut it down a little bit, but it was comprised of 3 core components. So we did, it was a 6-week intervention where we also had on the front and back end also health fairs for data collection purposes. But we did 6 mindful parenting workshops that focused on child behaviors. And these included healthy eating, meal times, and physical literacy. And then simultaneously, the children were, we called them sporkshops. They had interactive workshops with that gave them opportunities to try new food, physically active. And they, it was also a time in which our apps, we created 4 custom child-driven game-based apps And they were introduced during the sport shops and provided also to parents on an iPad for use for the length of the intervention. So just a quick background to give you an idea of our audience in who we'll be discussing. It's 33 mother-child dyads that were in two cohorts, fall of 2019 and then winter into spring of 2020. These families were recruited from Head Start or preschools that serve low-income families, as I mentioned, in rural Colorado. Just to provide some baseline data of who the children are that we were trying to influence. So related to diet, less than 45% were willing to try a new food when given the opportunity. So that was one of our behavioral targets, was to enhance offering of new foods as well as trying of new foods. Physical activities measured by accelerometers, they were below the recommendation of 60 minutes of moderate vigorous physical activity. In fact, our sample were only getting about 13 minutes. So they quite, there's a lot of room for improvement. And then screen time exceeded the recommendations of less than 60 minutes per day. And was the average was about 98 minutes per day. So you may be thinking, well, then why the heck are you trying to introduce mobile apps and enhancing screen time? But rather, we like to see this as substituting screen time with something that is of educational quality or could get children to build healthy behaviors. And that's what we will hopefully demonstrate to you today. So I'm going to turn it over to Shariva to talk about key considerations in development.
Yes, thank you, Laura. So there were two main key considerations during the development process of these apps. The first consideration was the app development partner, which I'll go into a little bit of detail about of who this partner was. And the second consideration was that of the user. And there were two main users that were considered during this development process. So because this was kind of like in the home environment, there was a family as a user. And in this case, the family, these families had limited resources and were living in rural communities. So Laura will dive a little bit more into about how the family about the family as a user and the information that was gathered during the formative research of the app. And then there was the preschooler as a user as well. And the preschooler brings up specific developmental considerations that impact the design decisions that were made during this development process. So I'll come back and talk about the preschooler as the user. And I'll hand it over. Oh, sorry. Next slide, please. So the partner in development, in building this suite of apps, the team partnered with New Mexico State's Innovative Media Research and Extension team. This was a team that included instructional designers, education and technology specialists, software and web developers, and artists and animators. And this team was an expert in designing and developing educational media. And now I'll hand it over to Laura to talk about the family unit as a user.
So we did a very robust formative research phase of this project, and we did both surveys and interviews with parents to try to understand how they were using the digital devices. So we asked parents about comfort with child use, and this was relatively high, that they were very comfortable with their children using mobile device, but it varied based on the type of device. They were much more comfortable with the tablet, less so with smartphones. And some parents did not let their children touch their smartphone because they didn't want them to break them, and even less with computers. We did find an association that those parents who had higher comfort also, it was associated with greater total child use. And this was both for parents' own comfort using technology, as well as the comfort of their child using their devices. An important thing we also wanted to suss out was that free apps was the way to go, and not surprising with a Head Start and lower income audience, and were very much less so interested in paying for apps. So other parts, and this came out of our interviews, were how are they using mobile devices? So this was an important part of families' everyday routines, and that parents did have parameters that govern their use. I would say this was relatively flexible, and it it deviated whether or not they needed to use the tool for behavioral management, such as if they were at a restaurant or in the car or at a doctor's appointment. They made very clear distinction between using apps for learning versus entertainment. And they had a desire for balance in regard to their child's use, but also recognized the importance of it as a learning tool, and they didn't want their child to fall behind educationally. And they were generally supportive of the idea of using mobile apps for intervention delivery.
So Laura talked about rural families with limited resources who have preschoolers as one type of user that we need to consider. But the other user to consider is the preschooler themselves, since they are a very unique age group with unique needs. So these apps needed to be developmentally appropriate. And so this means that they needed to use graphics and images and have clear and simple instructions and have an intuitive interface. And they also needed to have meaningful content that was able to tap into the cognitive and physical and emotional domains of the preschooler. And this content also needed to provide opportunities for children to learn through error and success. And the interactivity of this content needed to have a mix of free play, where the child might navigate through the content using their own decision making, and guided play, where a digital character or avatar might lead a child on their journey throughout the content. And finally, there needed to be opportunities for parental co-participation, since Laura talked earlier about the American Academy of Pediatrics guidelines for digital media use in children and the recommendations for active parental engagement in technology. So these preschooler-specific considerations taken together with the consideration for families, it really painted a picture for the user-centered design aspect of developing these apps.
So now we'll transition to talk to describing the Foods and Moves apps. Next slide, please. As a part of the HEROES intervention, four custom child-centered game-based apps were developed as part of a suite called the Foods and Moves. And what you have on the top of your screen are the the eight characters that appear throughout the four apps. And the apps were Jungle Gym 1, Jungle Gym 2, let me change my screen briefly. Spin and Move, as well as Tasting Party Express. And these apps were designed to engage preschoolers in physical activity and trying new foods. And I will go through some video clips in the coming slides, but I wanted to give you a general idea of what the apps are. Next, please. So before I dive into those video clips, I wanted to provide a general structure of the apps. And for this, I'm using Jungle Gym as an example. So the welcoming screen has a go button, which selects at random an activity scene, as well as a scenes option, which opens up the activity selection screen that you see on your top right. And it has, as you can see, there's a series of scenes for specific movements. And with Jungle Gym June, Jungle Gym 1, excuse me, the movements are introduced individually, and these movements can be running, galloping, slide stepping, and so forth. So once an activity is selected, whether intentionally selected or randomly selected, it takes the user to a guided activity that we see on the bottom. So the movement here is slide step, and it uses the context of the scene. So here it would be slide step to the right, for example, consistently using movement-related concepts, such as direction, as well as timing. With direction could be to the right, with timing could be do it slowly, and so forth. And the context here for slide stepping is like, make sure you're quiet so we don't wake up the sleeping cubs. And if you can hit next, please. So something I wanted to bring up before we move forward is that the guided activities use voice as well as music, but these can be muted. Oh, it looks like we lost the share.
So Laura, so that you know, we're not seeing the video, we're seeing your background for your computer.
Oh, I know, because
okay.
My computer just decided to change displays on me.
Sorry about that. I just wanted to make sure you realized.
Yeah, hold on just one sec. Let's see. Is that better?
Nope. Oh, yes. There we are. We're back to your computer, to the slide deck.
Okay.
So, Laura, what you'll probably want to do is stop sharing, get the video kind of queued up in a window on your computer, and then go and click share again, and then select that window. And then also make sure when you're in the process of selecting it, that you select the option for share computer sound or whatever it says that's along those.
Yep, hold on. Sorry, there's always technical issues, aren't there? Wahia, it might be, I don't know if you can, my computer's completely frozen. Yeah. Can you pull it up to share?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Sorry, apologies.
That's all right. That's all right. Just give me a moment.
Yeah, if you'd like, I can also, it's easier for you.
Can we see the correct screen?
We can see the title slide.
The title slides. Okay, great. I'll speed forward.
Okay. It has not advanced, though. There we go.
Just here. At some point, you don't see something, please. Feel free to alert me. Okay, so we talked about that this can be muted. At the bottom of the screen, we can also see an avatar. And I think this is really important because while during the guided activity, it is also demonstrating what the movement looks like for the child, for the user. Okay, so what I have here is just wanna show you briefly what the apps actually look like. So for Jungle Gym 2, and I recognize there's no sound, but that's okay. I will walk you through it. So what we have here is Jungle Gym 2, which is the more advanced version of Jungle Gym 1. And what we see with this app is that like Jungle Gym 1, which introduces one movement at a time, here begins to combine them. So here it's saying, leap forward so we can, but make sure not to get muddy. And then here we transition towards gallop quickly, like a horse. And it does something similar for other scenes. So this is entering into a new scene. So I'm gonna move forward to another clip. Okay, so next we have Spin and Move. And Spin and Move is another app designed to encourage movement. And what we have here are four different wheels, and this represent, would indicate move like a food or going on a picnic, move like an animal or going to the park. So then the activity is selected and it opens up to a given wheel. And what we'll see here is that the wheel is move like a food. So once the lever is pulled, it lands on a given food. So here we have, here the activity would be bend like a banana. And then it would also add direction to move to the side, but also to the, and then to the other side. So Okay, and this are it just continues through more examples. So I'm going to move ahead into the next application. Oh, maybe not. So here we have Tasting Party Express, and Tasting Party Express is designed to help with trying new foods. And at the beginning of the app, the user gets to select their characters, and they get to drag and drop foods to their characters to see different reactions that they have. And they use vocabulary such as that's about taste, such as salty or sweet, as well as texture, crunchy, chewy, but just general reactions such as yum or yuck or burping, for example. What we have here is a change of scene. So we went from a car to a submarine. Throughout the app, the user has the space to change their character. Something to note here is that a given food item won't disappear until it has been offered a number of times before a new item can be introduced at the bottom. So I'm going to move on. Okay. So now I'm going to transition to talk about participant engagement with the apps in the Heroes Intervention. So the apps were introduced to preschoolers and parents in parallel workshops over the course of 6 weeks. And I'll start with the child workshops during weeks 1 and 4. One app was introduced each week, and this was researcher-led. And during the introduction, the apps were projected either on a wall, but also children were given time to play with the apps on their own. During weeks 5 and 6, after the apps had been introduced individually, children were given the choice to use to play with the apps for 15 minutes. So moving on to parent workshops, which again are happening in parallel, at the end of their own workshop, parents received a description of the app that their child was introduced that week, location of the app on the iPad, as well as guidance on how to use the apps at home, but also really in general, their setting of choice. During weeks 5 and 6, parents continued to be encouraged to co-play with the apps, and reiteration about the behavioral objectives and how the apps support children engaging in these behaviors. So what I have here is an illustration of how preschoolers engage with the apps during the workshops. So I mentioned that the apps were projected on a wall. So here we see Jungle Gym 1, and we see kids up and moving around. And I think this is something to keep in mind as we'll see later on. And then on the right side, we see children engaging with Tasting Party Express, which again does require direct interaction with the device. So here we're getting into evaluation. And for parents' acceptability, we use an 8-item questionnaire with 5 and 3-point Likert scales. And the items were adapted from an existing scale called MARS, or the Mobile Application Rating Scale. And this questionnaire was administered post-intervention as well as analyzed descriptively. So what we're showing you here is the perceived behavioral benefits. And from this, we learned that 93% of parents agreed or strongly agreed that the Jungle Gym apps were likely to increase physical activity in their child. 77% agreed or strongly agreed that spin and move was likely to increase physical activity. And 63% that Tasting Party Express was likely to help their child try new foods. So as part of acceptability, we also looked at frequency of continued use over the next 12 months. So the extent to which they projected that they would use the apps. And 34% of parents projected that their use would be high or over 50 times, 24% that it would be moderate, and 33% that it would be low. In terms of likelihood to recommend the apps to others who might benefit from them, over 80% of parents reported that they were likely or very likely to recommend the apps, looking at app rating between 37 to 42% of parents rated the apps 5 stars, and 35 to 59% rated them 4 stars. So I just talked about parental acceptability, and this is not in the paper, but as part of this intervention, we also looked at whether children are actually engaging in some of those behaviors. So here we're looking specifically at the physical activity apps or the apps assigned to engage, to promote these behaviors. And preschoolers' physical activity was objectively measured using accelerometers during group play. And we learned that 80% of the apps produce 80% MVPA per 7 minute intervals. So of the 7 minutes that the apps lasted, especially the jungle gym apps, 80% of that time was spent in MVPA. So this tells us something about not only are they acceptable, but also the children are actually engaging in those behaviors. So a takeaway from this is that child-centered mobile apps have the potential to make significant contributions to preschoolers of all PA levels. So this brings me to some points for discussion and implications about the Foods and Moves apps. And that is to give critical consideration to the roles and skills of parents and children in app design. Children need their parents to help them understand the content that they're being exposed to, as well as monitor the quality of the digital screen time that they're spending. And parents, on their part, need the digital skills as well as an overall understanding of what children are navigating to help their children optimize their learning opportunities. So what we learned from our evaluation is that there really is high acceptability of the apps among parents, especially as it relates to behavioral benefits for children. And we saw this especially for physical activity. And the apps had high rating. They were projected to be used really high, as well as likelihood to recommend to others. So as we think about the potential of educational apps to substitute entertainment apps, and how this can, how these apps can help substitute sedentary time for active screen time, we have a lot of potential in this area. So the apps were used as part of the intervention, and we learned that they are feasible as an intervention modality for Head Start families. And from the slide that I just presented, we also learned that the Foods and Move apps are effective at engaging preschoolers in target behaviors. So I turn it over to Laura now.
Yeah, so part of our grant, we also wanted to make sure that our apps were, out there and we could disseminate those. And so we developed them in iOS. And so they were available initially at the start of the study, just in the App Store. But recognizing that a lot of our lower income populations don't have Apple, they actually have Androids. And so New Mexico State was great at building a second version that could be used in the Google Play Store. And you can see collectively since 2019, we've had over about 460,000 downloads worldwide, a lot in the US, but also in Brazil and the UK and other countries. And most of them of late, and you can see in the Google Play under 2023 and 2024, a good percentage of those are coming for Android use. So this, we've done some press releases and so forth, but not a whole lot of marketing per se with that. Next slide, Lydia. So I did want to just give a sense of what happens behind the scenes and how does Barb and her team make the magic work to get to the apps before we get into a discussion. So next slide. And so how did we get here? And I think we'll talk a little bit about this in our Q&A, but there's a lot of interaction. So you can see that there was several universities. And before I was at Cornell, I was at Colorado State. So between Colorado State, University of Colorado, and New Mexico State, we had a group brainstorming. We had multi-day on-site and virtual meetings to kind of come up with what are we going to do. We developed product proposals and scripts. New Mexico State pre-tested the avatars and the characters with preschoolers down in New Mexico. We tested the apps and with preschoolers and parents in Colorado. And so lots of pre-testing, lots of going back and forth. And then we did pilot and outcome testing as well. Next slide. And this is just an early schematic of what New Mexico State, of how they created an initial document for us. And so we were very clear as a team on what was the description. So this is for the Tasting at Party Express, which was originally called Feed the Creatures as our working title. But as a team, we knew what our objective was, that we wanted to demonstrate trying new food can be fun, reduce the fear of trying new food, and so forth. So we also came up with measurable outcomes for the children and parents, clear ideas on what the character design, next slide, or next click, yep. And then the New Mexico State team worked through what the game mechanics would be and the specifications. And so, you know, under specifications, it would be that there would be three characters, we would have four foods, what would those foods look like? How do those foods relate to our, you know, from a behavioral perspective of getting kids to try new foods? What's a new food? What's a familiar food? And then we had reactions. And this was a big part of making it fun for the kids, but also wanted to reiterate the message of we don't expect you to try it on the first time. There's going to be some rejection. And if you click the next slide, you can see here we talk through what are the reactions. If they're going to eat it, do they like it? Is it neutral? Is it a dislike or a yuck, or are they going to refuse to eat it? So we had those reactions that could be randomized, which is what the programmers did, or it could follow a logic. And then we worked as a team for developmentally, what are the sounds, right? So the monsters burp, they shudder, you know, or they go, or they look like they're surprised and they really like it. So trying to get, you know, realistic reactions and making kids comfortable with trying the foods, but also introducing vocabulary related to trying foods, related to the taste, the texture, and so forth. So these were all things that we worked through before things were actually programmed. Next slide. And so I think now would be a great time. We're going to do a reflection and insight, which Susan is going to lead us on. But before we do that, because I know we won't come back to it, I'm going to do the quick next slide, just to let you know that if you go to foodsandmoves.org, or you can take a picture of the QR code, these apps are free and available for use. Next slide, Lahia. And then I just do want to acknowledge the funding for this project was through a USDA AFRI childhood obesity grant. You can see the universities, and certainly none of this work would be available without our partners in our Head Starts and preschools. So with that, we are done with the slide deck, and I'll turn it over to Susan.
That's perfect. Thanks to all of you for a tremendous introduction to everything there. And part of what we want to do in this next bit is to acknowledge that, you know, grants go in fits and starts. And I think an important thing for us to say is this was always fun. This was a highly creative, really engaging process that I had certainly never engaged with a shop like Barb's before. And led to a whole new layer of things to think about, but also some challenges to transcend. And so we thought we would just do a brief bit here on what were some of the lessons learned. And for this, I'm gonna ask Barb and Laura to both unmute and speak up to some of the things that we thought about that we learned along the way. So if you would each talk just a bit about getting the grant started, because this was so new and big for all of us. What were the fits and what were the starts that were associated with that?
So I'll start. I'll back up just a little and say that this grant was written when I had a preschooler and as a parent, and that's where this kind of came from. And I thought, oh, if he's learning how to draw his letters and count, then why don't we teach kids how to try new foods and be active? So I was excited about that, and then realized once we got the grant that I had no idea what I was doing. But fortunately, we partnered, I think, and this is one of the lessons learned, is making sure you partner with really great people. And that's where Barb and New Mexico State came in, because they had the experience to take the ideas to fruition. It was a relatively large grant with a large team. And so also, you know, making sure that all of our strengths were being utilized. And getting it going was just understanding what the process was. And I think Barb will touch on the process because it's like, where do you even start, right? Like, what do you even do to get going on an app? And so her team was pretty instrumental in walking us through what are the key considerations and what is the information we know we have and what is the information or the questions that we still need to find out, such as how do parents use devices with their children and so forth. So I'll pause there and let Barb jump in.
Thanks, Laura. I would echo this was a large team, but this is a dream team for us to have researchers committed to researching at every stage. So we had research on which the app design was founded, research that happened during development of the app, extensive user testing, as well as physical activity testing. Were these apps getting us to our goals as we thought? And then really beautiful summative evaluation as well to measure impact. So for that, it was just a joy to work with this team. The other takeaway that was interesting for me is while we have been doing interactive media for years and years and years and worked with many different fantastic clients at different universities and elsewhere, Laura did something very smart on this. When we first started and I explained how we have our design summits and what they're like, and once we get the research done, we'll have a design summit. And she said, I think my team would do better if we could get a picture of what that looks like. Can you come kind of do a practice design summit for us? And I thought, well, that's unusual. We haven't done that before. But what happened from that was it was a really great takeaway for me of the value of explaining what our design process is like to our researchers. So since then, I've kind of codified that into a transformational design process, which is first we look at who we're trying to change, how are they going to be different before and after, what kind of activities they have to go through to do that change, and then how do we use apps or media or games or whatever we're developing to engage our user in that activity. So something that hasn't been mentioned that I think is interesting is these apps have two audiences. The first is the kids. Of course, we want to engage the kids. We want to get them to do that. But the second, and I would argue a major audience for this, is the adults that we were trying to, and we knew from the very beginning, we wanted to change the way parents or caregivers or family members interacted with their children that they were working with about eating and physical activity. We had a very specific list of objectives in how we wanted to encourage these kids at different ages to do cross-dominant in those 8 essential key physical activities. We had very specific research on how we talk to kids and how we get them to respond to tasting and trying and describing food. So a lot of our attention on these apps were apps that kids could use, that parents would hear, so that parents would then model that behavior with kids so that when you're standing in line at the grocery store, your kids are getting restless, you can say, hey, let's jump like a frog, let's leap, let's play. And when kids are given something new to try, parents could pull some of that dialogue and say, well, what do you think it tastes like? So there was a lot of modeling that we specifically designed these apps to do for adults. So for me, there is a very powerful takeaway in our design process, which is to go through that process, take the time it takes to make sure everybody on the team understands how development happens, that it's iterative, and then how we'll use research at all the different phases to make sure the app or the media changes the way it needs to.
And I'll just add to that too, is understanding developmentally for preschoolers, right? I think that was a large conversation we had of just because technology has lots of bells and whistles does not mean this age group needed that. And you can also, to Barb's point about the audience also being the parents, when we look at the acceptability, the Tasting Party Express is not rated very high because parents think it's boring to just drag and drop a piece of food on a plate and a monster makes a noise and then they keep doing it. We had to pull the tablets away from the kids on that because they love playing that. But we can't talk to these kids and get an evaluation the same way we do with older kids. So we got, you know, we definitely have anecdotal and observational of how they used it, but we relied on parents for feedback. And I think the lesson there is parents have one view, but it doesn't always match up with how children of this age like to play. And simplicity is also our friend, and repetition, right? And we know that about preschoolers.
Yeah, to sort of riff on that point, I remember there being a sort of crucial point in trying to decide who the characters were going to be and what should those images represent. And I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about how we came to our final choice of what those images for the characters look like.
Oh, I'd love to. So as with all of our development, it's both applied research and informed research. So we had Dr. Amanda Armstrong was really instrumental in this process, and we just had an article accepted that describes our views on how we looked at designing characters for this project specifically. So we started with what the research tells us, because at the end of the day, we wanted our youth, the kids playing this, to see themselves in the characters. We wanted them to say, oh, it's so frustrating when that monster refuses to eat anything. Oh, maybe I need to be thinking about that. So paramount was that the kids could see themselves in this. So looked at the research. There's a lot of research on that. I call it the Elmo factor, that often with monsters or non-human characters, kids are better able to see themselves in a wider variety, because representation and kids seeing themselves is so critical in changing their behavior. So as we dived into this research, we also did a lot of user testing. So we went to preschools and had kids draw pictures of their favorite character and what did they look like. And we showed them pictures of characters. So we really expanded our user testing research for this preschool audience, which in some cases is verbal in different ways and play in different ways. We had a lot of play activities to get the idea of characters. And where we finally landed was, while monsters or non-human characters do give kids a chance to imagine themselves in the character, they also need that human interaction. And there's a lot of human faces that don't get represented in our media. So we felt in contributing our apps to the larger collection of apps available for preschool and early learners, we also wanted to make sure we saw some diversity in those faces. So in the end, we started testing both humans and monsters. And that's what we ended up with going with, because it also modeled more subtly that we all have different kinds of friends that we play with, and different people react in different ways. And so there's a lot of kind of just central learning around who we are and how we are different from each other and how we view things differently that came in. So it was a really great learning experience for us. And on our end, our team was doing research on character design and user testing with preschools that informed this, preschoolers, well, with early learners at preschools.
And I'm going to steal Kristen's job here, because there's a very timely question in the Q&A, and it's from Renee Cole, who asks, what was the average time for an app bout? Did you find similar times between the exercise and the tasting app?
So for Jungle Gym 1 and Jungle Gym 2, it's about 7 minutes, because it's randomized and let the activities are led by the characters. For Spin and Move and Tasting Prey Express, kids can continue to do that. So it was, you know, there wasn't a timeline. They could just drag and drop all day long if they wanted. Same with pulling the lever on the spinner.
And so they kind of did it until we took it away from them.
Right.
So, we don't have an endpoint.
No. So but there is some monitoring there, right? That you don't, as a parent, that you want to make sure that they're not just doing it forever and ever and ever. But I'll mention the 7 minutes. When we saw the 80% MVPA, which is about 5.5 minutes of MVPA, with our baseline data, the kids were only getting 13 minutes of MVPA. So by going through Jungle Gym 1 or 2 twice is almost doubling their MVPA. So the impact that, you know, apps can potentially have by providing indoor physical activity at a time and place that is convenient for the parents, I think can potentially have a nice impact.
Can I just add on to that, that timing? I appreciate you asking that question, Renee, because the timing was part of our intentional design process. Was we said, how long do we want them for? How long do we have them for? And how frequently do we think they will use the app? So we designed intentionally so that there's some randomization of Jungle Gym, so that when you come and play it, it's going to feel different than the last time you played it. There's randomization in that Spin and Move. There's randomization of the characters. So we balanced both autonomy, where the player gets to choose characters and make choice, with random actions, so that it felt fresh, because we wanted to encourage that repeat viewing and repeat use.
And if I remember right, Barb, you know, one of our concerns early on was that they weren't going to play this repeatedly, that they would get bored with it and lay it down, and, you know, all that development would be for 3 times through. Can you tell us how that panned out?
And that's the beauty of user testing. You know, you can design on a board as much as you want. You can come up with some ideas. So it's really important to do user testing throughout. So as soon as we had kind of a rough playable, we put it in front of kids. And you're like, we think this is fun. Do they think it's going to be fun? And then we just sit and watch. And one of the best experiences you can have in user testing is the kids don't want to leave. And once we got to the point where the parents would do it at the end of some of our user testing would do it at the end of the day at preschools when parents were coming. So we could have the parents sign the consent form and the parents would play with them. And when the parents would be kind of like, okay, come on, guys, and have to pull their kids away. We're like, got it. And so that was sort of our measure of success, was getting it to the point where the kids didn't want to stop.
Yeah, and go ahead, Laura.
I was just going to add one quick comment about the challenge with this age group is that parents are the gatekeepers. So even if the kids wanted to play it, right? And so I think from our experience, kids would continue to play it, whether or not it's offered to be continued to play, I think is our bigger challenge.
Right. And designing audio so that parents didn't get annoyed and mute it, or get frustrated by the same sounds and ask the kids to stop. So there is a lot of attention we paid to who were the people overhearing that play going on.
Well, and that was purposeful that we put a mute button in there so parents could mute the song in the background. Again, I had come up with this when I had a preschooler, and that was a absolute must of, I can't handle hearing it all day long.
Can I ask a question? Did you get a feel of, or did you measure when the kids were playing the two activity games, did any of the kids just watch the characters play and move it through, or were all of the kids actually engaging in activity while they were watching the app?
So what we were able to observe in the actual workshops, all the children participated. What we don't know, because we were limited in what we could do with the research, and I think it opens up, is like, what are they actually doing at home? Mm-hmm. And that it were they watching it, I don't know, versus engaging in it. But I'm also, the question is, you know, I know we talked a lot about co-play and co-viewing. We also presented it to parents as, if you need to get dinner on the table or throw a load of laundry in, they were developed to be that children could do it on their own as well. Because we knew the ideal, but we also know what it's like to be, again, a parent of a young child. If sometimes you just need that 7-minute break to breathe or go to the bathroom or do something. So that's the next question, is what they actually do with it in the home environment and how they're using it.
Yeah, so I'm going to ask a question next. It's a little bit of a ringer, but you know, you've had 460,000 plus downloads. Do you have any moments of, oh, maybe we should have made this a paid app? Tell us your perspective on how apps like this, you know, generally work financially.
Yeah, so let's do a reality check on this. First off, we need to understand that downloaded apps aren't always used apps. And those are very specific for platform as well. In general, in the past, when we could track some of it, and I don't know how much of it has changed, when we did some search on these apps, they were more likely, on other apps, paid apps got downloaded less, but used more. Free apps got downloaded more but used less, which just means you value what you pay for, right? If you're going to pay for an app, you're going to be more likely to use it. However, when we, on a previous set of apps, we were comparing two very similar apps. The ones that got downloaded in such huge numbers for free that even if a smaller percentage got used, more were used. So we had done that study when we came into this app, and we said, that's why we think we ought to do this for free. We think if it's free, it's going to get downloaded more. Plus, we are looking at our audience and where their app money would go. So that's one important notice. The second thing was just sort of a mindset for us, which is, we're a university, we are doing federally funded grant work. We felt like this is what we owed our constituents and our clientele in Extension and elsewhere, to be using this information for free. So part of that was just personal choice for all of us on the team. And then the third was, we have experimented in our shop with paid app, and I think maybe we made like $1,200. I mean, it didn't even cover the cost of paying a programmer to keep with the updates. So our shop where we stand right now, April 22nd, 2024, is paid apps. Ugh, forget about it. It just, I have this fantasy that sometime we might have a paid app that would actually cover the cost of keeping apps maintained. But we feel compelled to deliver, especially on grant funding, value to our clientele nationally. And it, I just feel like we want to have more downloads. So that was a discussion we had earlier on with this group is, ooh, can we pay and having a sustaining program? It would be lovely if one of the outcomes of this grant would be to reap in the hundreds of thousand dollars to keep making more apps to put them out to the world. But our experience did not show that that was going to be the case. Sorry to burst anyone's bubble.
No, well, I think it's important for us to like give all the lessons learned. And so I think you've slid a really important point in that last answer, and that's about updates. You know, every app I have wants me to update, and how do you manage that?
So that's one of the, you know, if we had been a paid business and you had come to us and paid us to create these apps, you would have to come and pay us to create those updates. And at some point we would have to moonlight the apps because your grant is over and you wouldn't be able to pay us to update that. And one of the reasons we were hesitant to go into the Android market is those updates to the, on the Android side and the sheer diversity of screen sizes and devices and operating systems on the Android side. We were a little nervous about that update. So one of the things we do here at New Mexico State University is we just do the best we can to keep those things updated. We have in the past had to pull other apps down when Flash, which was an operating mechanism within browsers that was supposed to, we had to just finally let go of some of our online games because we couldn't keep them updated anymore for the cost. So far with apps, we're able to go in and make those occasional updates. We're not changing the game or updating the gameplay. We're just updating them as needed to keep them working on the systems as the operating systems update. So we're going to keep doing that as long as we can until it becomes onerous and we can't do it with the resources that we have. But it's a very important consideration for anybody thinking of app development in the future is to have those conversations with your developers. When will it be sunsetted and who's going to be responsible for the updates and the costs of the updates to keep those apps working and functional after the end of a grant?
That's fabulous. Thank you. That's a thing that I think, you know, we on the our part of things wouldn't have necessarily thought about on the tail end of an app. Right. And you have that knowledge. Laura, I'm going to ask you one last question. And it was in our discussions when we were deciding how to make the apps available to families, we struggled a bit. And our initial decision was, we want to give them these apps on a tablet and we want to lock it down and only give them access to these apps to make sure that that's what they're doing with this tablet. Could you talk a little bit about, you know, how we ended up changing our mind on that?
Yeah, I think one of our big questions and a question that even reviewers of the grant said, like, you're going to give these families just an iPad. What are you going to ask for them? Are you going to ask for it back? How are you going to ask them to use it? And I think we thought initially of, well, if we just have them do what we need to do, they won't get distracted and they won't get shared with, you know, other family members that might not need to be using it, like versus it needs to be used with the preschooler. But as a team, and I think Barb, you know, was really helpful in this conversation as well. Well, if they only use it for one thing, it doesn't get incorporated into daily life, right? And so we knew we were developing it on iOS for another set of reasons, but we also figured out once we had already kind of started the research that a lot of our families didn't have Apple. And so we knew we needed to provide them with the device itself. Parents felt really comfortable having the device, but we wanted to make sure it got incorporated. And so we chose to not lock it down and let them use it however they wanted to use it so that it kind of got incorporated into daily use.
And so one last quick question, and I was typing a response to Shree, but Shree's asked, you know, it's an amazing program, but is there a classroom component? And has it been used in the classroom as well as in the family setting? And is there a plan for that?
It's a great question, Sri. You know, we, because this project was focused solely on home environment, but a lot of the activities got pulled from our center-based programming. We made this available to teachers that they could use it as and put it in their toolkit, you know, to use within the classroom, but we did not purposely position it in that way. But I see value in, we've made it available to teachers now here in New York, you know, just at least promoted it to say, hey, if you need a tool, these are some apps that, you know, you could use. So I think it can be incorporated. It just wasn't the purpose of how we positioned it for this grant.
And it is available on the App Store and the Play Store, and Barb has put the link to it online. And so, you know, it's yours to download. Mm-hmm. And I see we are at time.
Yeah. So first of all, thank you all for being here today to share your knowledge and experience with us. I just have a few final reminders. For all of our attendees, please do complete that survey. Once we close out the session, we do appreciate your feedback. Be on the lookout for that follow-up email with the recording, handouts, and your CEU certificate. And if you enjoyed today's webinar, be sure to check out the upcoming webinar section of the website. Journal Club continues next Monday. That concludes today's session. Thank you for joining us and have a great day.
Thank you.
Thanks.